Hello, this is The Schwepp, the Secret History of Western Esotericism podcast. I'm Earl Fontenelle, and today I'm speaking with Peter Adamson, a professor of late antique and Arabic philosophy at the LMU in Munich, a man who does an amazing podcast off his own back, The History of Philosophy Without Any Gaps, and has published extensively in the field of medieval philosophy, especially Arabic philosophy, especially wonderful transition point between late antiquity into the medieval period, when the Arabs provide so much of the heat of what's happening in philosophy. Peter, thank you so much for coming back to the Schwepp. I hugely appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you. It's great to be on again.
Let us talk about the Proclus reception in the Arab world, well, in the Islamicate world. So if I were to ask you, if I were to come up to you in the street, which I'm sure happens to you all the time, kind of grab you by the lapel and say, explain to me the Proclus reception in Arabic in an overarching way, and you were under the gun, how would you do that before we get into the nitty gritty of details and stuff like that?
Yeah, if I had a dollar for every time that's happened to me. Of course, it usually happens to me in German because I'm here in Munich. But so that's a good question, which we obviously need to get into as background for everything we're about to discuss. The context for this is the 9th century translation circle that's gathered around a philosopher named Al-Kindi. Al-Kindi is usually considered the first philosopher to write in Arabic. I'm sure you're going to cover him because he has a lot to say about magic and related topics, astrology and so on. And one of the things that he was doing, perhaps the main thing he was doing, in addition to writing his own treatises, was organizing the efforts of a group of translators who were mostly, if not all, Christians. And they are rendering works from Greek into Arabic. There's a little bit of uncertainty as to whether their translations are ever based on Syriac intermediary texts, because with some translations, we know that a Greek version was translated into Syriac, which is a Semitic language. And then that would be the hard part. Then the easy part is to translate that into Arabic, right? From one Semitic language into another.
Yeah. So it's going to be easier to go from Syriac to Arabic than absolutely from Greek to right. Arabic, in other words.
So a related text that we'll probably talk about, which is the Arabic Plotinus, there's a debate among scholars as to whether that was translated directly from Greek or from Syriac, which was itself based on Greek. But in any case, whatever they've got, they are translating some writings by Proclus, especially his Elements of Theology, into Arabic, and that happens in the 9th century.
Okay.
And then there's a complicated problem, which is that the Proclus materials then turn up in various different guises. So you might think of these as different editions or redactions of the Arabic version of the Elements of Theology. One of them goes under the title of Book of the Pure Good, and that's the version that was then translated into Latin as the Liber de Causis, or Book of Causes, and that was a really influential work that is actually one of the main sources for Neoplatonic ideas in the Latin scholastic world. So for someone like Aquinas, for example.
Mm. But the problem, of course, as we discussed way, way back on the podcast, actually, in episode 39, where we talked about the esoteric Aristotle and the many different sort of hats that the character of Aristotle has worn through history. This book isn't by Proclus anymore. It's by Aristotle, right? It's been attributed to
right.
Aristotle.
Yeah, that's right. So even in Latin, it travels under the authorship of Aristotle. And people are suspicious about this the whole time. And in fact, it was Thomas Aquinas, the just mentioned Thomas Aquinas, who announced to the world that actually the Liber de Causis, the Book of Causes, was based on Proclus's Elements, because his collaborator, translator William of Moabeca, got his hands on the Proclus in Greek, and they compared, and it was immediately clear that that's what they were dealing with. So that was when it was kind of figured out that it wasn't a work of Aristotle. I mean, I think one can maybe sort of read too much into this idea that some of these Neoplatonic works travel under the name of Aristotle, because there always seems to have been some kind of reluctance to say that that's true, that is really okay. By Aristotle. So
Ibn Rushd also kind of doubts that corpus, doesn't he?
I think that the most famous case is actually Ibn Sina, not Ibn Rushd.
Ibn Sina, okay.
Yeah, where I mean, certainly Imrosh doesn't do anything with it. So Averroes, as we sometimes call him, doesn't do anything with
it. He might just be beyond it altogether. Like, of course, I'm not even going to look at that stuff. Let's
but
really
he
talk
may
about
not
it or
even
something.
have had it, actually. So the more interesting case is Ibn Sina, or who we sometimes call Avicenna, who wrote some comments on the related Arabic Plotinus text. And he says, when he's talking about why he did this, he said, well, there's some doubt about whether this is really authentic, but I did it anyway. Right?
Right.
So I think part of what's going on here is that they think that anything that's based on Greek philosophical sources is kind of interesting anyway. And it's clearly an interesting text. And it might be very convenient to think it's by Aristotle because it injects all of this Neoplatonism into the Aristotelian corpus.
Right.
So for certain purposes, people want to say it's by him. But I think it's hard to tell how many relevant philosophers would have, like, you know, bet money on it really being by Aristotle.
That's really interesting. I also question that. And thank you for questioning that, because it's too easy to fall into the idea that, like, well, there's just Aristotle got a good shot of late Platonism in the arm, and then that's what the Islamicate and then, you know, post-Islamicate Latin Aristotelianism or Peripateticism is all about in the Middle Ages. It's Aristotle plus, like, some juicy theology from Proclus and Plotinus. And that, you know, juicy theology end of things then, of course, very naturally interacts with the works of the Pseudo-Dionysius, and you end up with this kind of endless possibilities for apophatic theology and stuff like that in Islamic philosophy, but also in, you know, Western Christendom.
Yeah, another thing that's worth bearing in mind is that already in late antiquity, so in some of the authors you've been covering, you already have a fusion of Aristotle with
right.
Neoplatonism, right? So Porphyry, or think about the commentaries that were done in Alexandria in the school of Ammonius. So they don't need to think that Plotinus and Proclus are Aristotle to be invested in a project that combines Platonism with Aristotelianism. They're doing that anyway.
Right.
And then it might additionally be interesting to think that this other text is by Aristotle, but it's not the decisive factor in making philosophy in the Islamic world into this both Platonic and Aristotelian project. That was going to happen anyway, because it'd been happening for centuries.
Great. So before we get into follow the trail of the Book of Causes, is that all we need to know about the Proclean reception? Is any other? I mean, I know, for example, that you know, all kinds of interesting, weird, and wonderful works get translated into Arabic. We have a Proclean work on, is it a commentary on the Golden Verses or something like that?
Commentary on the Golden Verses, yeah.
In Arabic.
Yeah.
So what else is out there by Proclus?
Yeah, the most important thing is probably that they're aware of the dispute between Philoponus and Proclus on the eternity of the world. Proclus wrote a text which has 18 arguments in favor of the eternity of the world, which is a standard Platonist position, and of course is an example of the Platonists agreeing with Aristotle, right? Because Aristotle explicitly says this.
Yep.
And Philoponus, who was a Christian commentator on Aristotle in Alexandria, wrote responses both to Aristotle and to Proclus, arguing against the eternity of the world. And again, there's a kind of complicated issue about exactly what they've got from this material, especially if Philoponus's response to Proclus is absolutely vast. I think the English translation of it, which now exists in English based on the original Greek, and I think it's 4 volumes.
Wow.
So that's a huge work. But the Proclus arguments are very brief. So it's 18 arguments, and each of them are about a paragraph long. And in fact, the Arabic tradition here is quite important, because the first argument is lost in Greek but preserved in Arabic.
Ah, perfect.
So we do know something about that tradition in terms of, like, the impact of Proclus on discussions of in the Arabic tradition on specifically this topic, the eternity of the world.
Got it. So there's that reception going on, and Proclus is known that way. And we have a few little funny bits and bobs that survive, like the short commentary on the Golden Verses of Pythagoras,
right.
That survives in Arabic, not in Greek, but in Arabic only. And then we are left with this extraordinary work, the Book of the Pure Good, known as Liber de Causis in Latin. Now, our listeners are familiar with the elements of theology. It's a very extraordinary, extremely difficult, extremely dry, but also sort of deeply rewarding in a certain way, work. Would they be right to think that the Liber de Causis is just a straight translation of Proclus's kind of Euclidean manual of metaphysics into word for word into Arabic?
Definitely not.
Right.
It's very far from being that. For starters, it's shorter. So it's a selection of the elements of theology. And it may even be that it's some kind of excerpted text based on a larger body of translated material from the elements of theology. There's actually different versions of this. There's a so-called Liber de Causis 2, which is slightly different from the first Liber de Causis. And then there's other Proclus material floating around that comes from the elements. So we've got this kind of main text, which in Arabic was actually called the Book of the Pure Good, Kitab al-Khair al-Maht, which is obviously different from the title Elements of Theology, and it's different from the title Book of Causes. So this one work goes under three different names in Greek, Arabic, and Latin, which is interesting. And I can't think of too many other books that are known by three different titles in three different languages. That's a rare feat, I would say. But going back to your question, it's not the same as the Elements of Theology. Not only is it shorter, but it's also rearranged. So the propositions are in a different order, which is alarming if you think that the whole point of the Elements of Theology is that it's supposed to be this, you know, merciless, logical, unfurling project,
right,
from first principles down to last proved theses.
Yeah.
It's not. So he's rearranged it a little bit. And the most important thing, though, is that the actual content has been adjusted. And interestingly, it's been adjusted to make it more like Plotinus.
That is interesting.
So something that your audience will be familiar with is that Proclus's, what you might call his cosmic hierarchy, is more complicated than Plotinus's, right? So in Plotinus, you've got the one, the intellect, soul, and then the natural world, and that's it. So you've got the three supernatural, if you want to call them that, or the intelligible hypostases, these principles that are above the physical world. There's only three. Whereas in Proclus, it's, you know, how many are there? It's like, how much time do you have?
Yeah.
Right. And you have Proclus distinguishing in the elements of theology very clearly between, for example, intelligible gods, intellective gods, and intelligible and intellective gods, right? So you have all these triadic structures. And as you say, there's this kind of implication that you could keep sort of in a sort of fractal kind of way, you could keep pursuing these distinctions as long as you would like to. I actually don't know that Proclus would in fact want to admit that it's an indefinite process, because of course part of his project is to associate these different principles with divine entities in Greek religion.
Yeah.
And so one reason he wants to have all of these gods and so on is that he can then say, okay, that's Hera or that's Venus or whatever.
Yeah. It kind of has to be infinite, though. The other thing he might want to avoid is an infinite regress, whereby you have infinite forms. Mm-hmm. And when the whole point of the theory, for one of the whole points of a theory of forms, is to have a smaller number of causative explanatory principles giving rise to a larger number of phenomena.
Yeah,
and this would make the larger number of causes and explanatory principles leading to a finite number of phenomena, which is a real problem, but not one he ever addresses.
I mean, and another factor to consider is that all the way, almost at the top of the hierarchy, we have these two principles called the limit and the unlimited, the Peres and Apeiron. They're right under the one, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if you want to put them somewhere, that's where you'd put them. But the reason I'm mentioning that is that everything that comes after them partakes of both of them. And so you don't want something lower down to be infinite, because we've already had the Apeiron up at the higher level.
Right.
So every level should somehow be limited, as well as somehow being unlimited.
Yeah.
Right. So in any case, the complexity that we get in the elements of theology is certainly profound. And there's a kind of threat of even more complexity that he hasn't even brought into the story here for these purposes. Whereas the hierarchy that you get in the Arabic Proclus is assimilated to the one we have in Plotinus. And that would already tell you that there's a very close relationship between the Arabic Plotinus and the Arabic Proclus.
Right.
And this, in turn, brings us back to the question about why do they think it's by Aristotle?
Okay.
So this, again, scholarly controversy about this, but especially a scholar named Fritz Zimmermann, who used to be at Oxford, has a very compelling story about this, which is that the Kindy Circle had all of this Greek material at their disposal, which they were translating into Arabic. Another German scholar, Gerhard Endres, in the 70s was actually the one who established that the Arabic Proclus was part of this material, was part of the material that was produced by the Kindy. So he did this kind of thing that like really good philologists can do, where they start analyzing linguistic features of the text and they show that it belongs to a certain kind of style of Arabic that was being written in Al-Kindi's circle. So he does this through, you know, comparisons of vocabulary, grammar, all the rest of it. And then Zimmermann said, well, actually, it looks like what happened is that Al-Kindi and his collaborators put together what Zimmermann called a metaphysics file. So it was work by Proclus and Plotinus, also Alexander of Aphrodisias, the second century commentator on Aristotle. And this would have been like a big book or even sort of stack of books, which was the original thing that they called the theology of Aristotle, or even just the theology, using the Arabic word that they use is just a transliteration of the Greek. So they call it apologia.
Right.
And this was a kind of resource for them to think about what the Greeks were saying about divine and intelligible principles. Okay. So that's what they've got originally. And it contained Plotinus, it contained Proclus, and it contained some other stuff as well. And then there was a preface, which comes down to us at the beginning of the Arabic Plotinus, but might have been a kind of prologue for the entire metaphysics file, in which it says, this is the completion of the philosophy of Aristotle, which might have meant when they wrote it, well, this is just like what you'd have to add to Aristotle to get the full story.
Right.
Of theology.
Just reverse engineering what the Platonists had done and saying Aristotle is a sort of preface to Plato.
Exactly.
And just saying, okay, Plato is the completion of Aristotle.
Absolutely. Yeah. And then possibly, and this is Zimmermann's hypothesis, which I find quite plausible, a scribe misunderstood this and thought that the idea was that it's actually by Aristotle.
Yeah.
And so that's how the name of Aristotle comes to be given as the author for both the Arabic Plotinus and the Arabic Proclus. And these texts then start circulating separately apart from the file. This might also explain why we've got several different versions and we've got kind of bits of the Arabic Plotinus. Like there's a big bit, which we call the theology of Aristotle. And then there's some other bits that circulate separately. So basically what we've got is all of these texts that emanate from this original project from Al-Kindi's circle. And these are the sources that you can turn to for the kind of purest Neoplatonism that's available in Arabic starting in the 9th century, also important up till the 11th, 12th centuries.
Fascinating. So that might also explain the out of orderness of the fragments of Proclus,
yeah,
right?
Exactly.
When they're just being excerpted and taken out of their context, so they become free-floating chunks of metaphysics, metaphysical theology, it's just going to be much more likely that they shift around than if they're locked in Proclus's rigid cause to effect corollary blah 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 structure. Mm-hmm. It's very hard for anything to shift if it's kept in that structure because it's so structured.
That's true. Although in another way, the elements of theology is very susceptible to being excerpted because you have these propositions with little chunks of remarks about them.
So it does come in bite-sized chunks already. Yeah.
Yeah.
It is.
So it kind of comes as pre-arranged as fragments.
Yeah.
Which you can then move around. There's another issue here, which is that the Arabic Plotinus is also incomplete, reordered, and to some extent chaotic. Like there are places where it just stops in the middle or starts in the middle.
Yeah.
And something else that scholars debate is how much of the ordering of the text is intentional and how much of it is like sort of the equivalent of someone dropping a bunch of papers on the floor and then gathering them back up, you know, without doing a very good job of figuring out how they were ordered originally. So you could imagine that there's some degree of textual mishap involved. So another scholar who's done a lot of work on the Arabic clocklist, probably the scholar who's done the most work on it actually, is Christina d'Ancona. And she thinks that the Book of the Pure Good is very carefully constructed. And she, in fact, she thinks even that it may have been done by Al-Kindi himself. And she and I have both argued that the theology of Aristotle shows some signs of textual chaos and corruption, but also shows some signs of intelligent ordering. So what we might have here are texts that are deliberately re-edited and reorganized, and then also subject to some difficult textual history where parts go missing, parts get reshuffled around, etc. So it's a very complicated textual situation.
So we have a move toward a more Platonian metaphysics. Do we also see any moves toward, in the process of translation, but also maybe in the process of excerption, toward something that's less, let's call it pagan or less polytheist? Is it being made more kind of usable by monotheists?
Absolutely. So one thing that happens in these Neoplatonic, Arabic Neoplatonic texts is that they actually just call the one the creator,
Okay.
al-Bari. So that's pretty clear, right? And anytime you would, so one of the things you don't get in the Arabic proclus that you would get in the Greek proclus is talk of gods in the plural, theoi, as opposed to theos. So we talked about the intelligible gods, the inductive gods, blah, 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 right? There's no plurality of gods here. So actually, in fact, this is one of the most kind of obvious things that that Kindi's team have done with the Neoplatonic texts, is that they've made it clear that there's only one divinity, and it's the divinity that Proclus and Plotinus would call the one, which means that they've all the kind of issues about negative theology and the emanation of everything from a single source, that's all there in the text. They really like that, but they don't like any suggestion of divinities other than the one. Here it might be worth remembering that the translators are Christians and that Kindi is a Muslim. So it's not clear, and I think probably is by design not clear, whether the divinity we have in mind here is the God of the Christians or the God of the Muslims. It's clearly could be both, right? And so you might imagine that the Christians and the Muslim leader of the circle are kind of agreeing to turn this Greek material into something that's compatible with Abrahamic creationist religion, but doesn't go more specific than that.
We have to admit that we don't actually know what went on there, but that seems as a very plausible way of seeing this process. Like, guys, we can all use this. I mean, one God did all the creating, no emanatory, second creator or anything like that, because we've had to, we've worked pretty hard to get rid of that model over the last few hundred years. Everyone cool? Yeah, looks good. Looks good. Okay, cool. Stamp.
Let's move forward.
Let's next.
Yeah, although actually, interestingly, one thing that they don't do is they don't eliminate the idea of emanation. So they still use the talk of emanation. So the Arabic word is fayd, which literally just means something pouring forth or emanating, right? And in fact, that idea then goes forward into Arabic philosophy, like you find it in Al-Farabi, you find it in Ibn Sina, and so on. So the idea that emanation is compatible with creation is coming in not only with these later philosophers, but is already here in the translation movement itself. And you might wonder what, like, how would that even make sense? Because people usually think of emanation and creationism as two alternatives. So either God or the first principle automatically emanates, pours forth all of existence, like a light shedding forth rays of light, or a fountain flooding forth water, right? That's one option. The other option is no, we have a supreme God who arbitrarily, by his own free will, chooses to create the universe, right?
And creates it out of nothing,
And creates that out of nothing.
as an
Absolutely.
extra thing added on.
And you might actually want to connect this to an issue that we were already talking about before, namely the eternity of the world. Because if you're an emanationist, you're almost guaranteed to think that the universe is eternal, right? Because God is just automatically giving forth the universe. So whenever there's God, you're going to have a universe. Whereas if you're a creationist, you may want to say that God created out of nothing at a time. So there was first nothing, and then there was a universe, right? You don't have to say that, but you can. You might want to, right?
It's not an uncommon position.
And you can see why, right? Because if the universe used to not exist and then started to exist, then clearly the universe is not necessary.
Right.
And that goes well with saying that God chose to create it, right?
Mm.
So the question then becomes, like, how can they say that their God is a creator if he's also emanating? And again, this is something that Dun Kona has written about. Something that you find in the Arabic Proclus is the formula that God creates everything else through the intermediary of the intellect.
Mm.
So rather than thinking of the intellect as the first effect of God or the one, which then gives rise to the soul or whatever would come next, the Arabic Proclus is saying, well, you have the first cause, you have God. It gives rise, or he, perhaps we should say, gives rise to the intellect. And then somehow using the intellect, he gives rise to everything else. And so this seems to be in part an attempt to avoid admitting that God lacks a direct relationship to, for example, you and me, right? So right. God is causing us to exist through an instrument, which is the intellect.
So that is such a fascinating synthesis of a number of competing demands on any monotheist creationist account, right? On the one hand, God does all the creating. We don't want any kind of demiurgic lower figure, because we're all Muslims stroke Orthodox Christians here, and we don't do that, arguably. Or if we're Christians, we say, yes, everything is created via Jesus, via the Son, but the Son and the Father and the Spirit are 100% the same hypostasis, so there's no subordinationism.
Yeah.
Either way, you can't have that subordinationism or that demiurgic figure. On the other hand, Proclus is, well, first of all, Proclus is, the source material is clearly emanationist, and the notion of a demiurgic nous is so powerful and so resonant, not only in the Platonist tradition, but also across various flavors of Christianity and so on, that I assume it kind of, you don't want to just chuck it out. Anyway, it's there. It's something you have to deal with.
Yeah.
Notions of creation from nothing versus creation ex nihilo versus a deo creation accounts, all of this kind of jostling around. And so you've got a source material, you're negotiating it somehow into a new language, but also into a kind of new thought world or a new ideological framework. And what you come up with is there's a kind of, you come up almost with a kind of back to the Timaeus view, where God creates a second order entity, and that does the work of further creation, right?
Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah. And in fact, something else that happens in the text is that they start to try to narrow the distance between the one and nous. So especially in Proclus, the one is very far away from being nous, right? So you have these intermediary principles. You have the henads, and you have limit and unlimited, for example, which are principles that somehow mediate between the one as a principle of complete unity and the intelligible cosmos, right? It's not quite that complicated in Plotinus, but no one would think that Plotinus's one is an intellect, right?
No.
It's very, very explicit that the intellect is not purely one, because it's both the subject and object of thought. It's the seat of all of the Platonic forms and so on. So there's lots of multiplicity, or there's different kinds of multiplicity in nous, and the one cannot be thinking. It has no forms inside it, etc. Whereas in the Arabic Plotinus and Proclus, you have a creator God in place of the one, who seems to be a lot more like nous.
Right.
So they still want to distinguish between the one and nous. And in fact, you might even think there's a little bit of internal tension here, because on the one hand, they very much like the apophatic negative theological aspect of Neoplatonism, where the one is transcendent above all description and all attributes, as they say. But on the other hand, they want to have God kind of being like an intellect who's deciding to create.
And might have
and so some
the forms within his mind, perhaps.
Yeah, exactly. So that kind of idea is suggested in some passages, but resolutely denied in other passages.
Right, okay. So that tension is like, it's a sort of a tension within, well, it's a sort of like the middle Platonist versus the Neoplatonist models, both present at the same time. And they're not quite compatible.
Yeah, right. If you think of someone like Philo of Alexandria.
Or Numenius.
And they actually have a principled way of splitting the difference too, because one idea you get in these texts is that everything that's in the lower effect is contained already in the upper cause, right? Which is a very Proclan idea, actually. Yeah. So everything... Did you hear that? There's a thunderstorm going on here, which is very Schwepp, I feel.
I didn't hear it. the algorithm must have blocked it out, but hopefully we'll get it in your recording.
Hopefully the listeners can hear it, because that's couldn't be more appropriate. So their idea then would be that whatever is present in nous must already be present in God or in the One, right? And so that would license this kind of assimilation of nous to the One to some extent.
Got it. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, that makes sense. Proclus would have a fit if you put that to him. He'd be like, "You're an idiot. You don't get what I'm saying."
Yeah.
Presence in the One in some potential form in Duname or in that's not the same thing as being present. The One is not a bloody attic full of stuff. It's a pure simplicity. But I can understand that move definitely when you're trying to have a monarchialist or a single god that really does all the work that we associate with monotheist gods.
It also solves himself a philosophical problem, right? Because if in classical Neoplatonism we're always wondering, well, where did all these forms come from, right? So the One emanates nous, and then the nous starts thinking, and oh, lo and behold, it starts thinking about all the forms. Where did that happen? Like why these forms? And I guess Plotinus's answer would be something like, well, nous is thinking about being, and the forms are just what there is.
Right.
So if it thinks about being, that's what it will think, right? Whereas the Arabic Plotinus and Proclus could say, well, no, actually, you've got the forms somehow kind of implicitly packed together in a more unified way up in God.
Right.
And then they're kind of fully realized or expressed at the level of nous.
Yeah. So it's like compression. They're like in a zip file in God's mind.
They're in a zip file.
And then they get decompressed into nous. And then the natural cosmos is a further decompression.
Absolutely.
Sorry for the computer metaphor. They're always dangerous things and a bit tacky, but not entirely unhelpful, I hope. I love this working through ideas. Thank you so much. This gives us an idea that the Arabic Proclus isn't the Proclus we know and love from Greek. Changes have occurred. Not only the name. In other words, he hasn't just transformed into Aristotle through some textual accident. He's also, his thought has been changed. And he's become a writer who is useful for monotheist theologians who want to make a philosophically compelling account of creation, of causation as well, how causation works. But he's not objectionable. This is what I find wonderful. On the one hand, you have this reception where you've got Philoponus refuting Proclus on the eternity of the world. And for obvious reasons, Christians and Muslims au fait with late antique Greek literature saw that debate, read it, and said, this guy Philoponus, he's got the juice. We can definitely use him in our work because he's dealing with this one real problem we have with Platonist cosmology, which is that there's no creation. It doesn't begin. It just is. It's just a continuum in both directions, as it were. So on the one hand, you've got that, and you can see how certain aspects of Proclus's arguments are being specifically picked out, rejected. This is wrong. This is wrong. This is wrong. But in this reception history, we have a process whereby instead of saying Proclus is wrong about this and that, perhaps the editors and translators have done that work for us by taking out bits or changing bits to make them not wrong. So now we have a Proclus who isn't wrong and can be received as as Aristotle, the unobjectionable. Increasingly, as the Middle Ages go on, I feel like all the monotheisms, the Abrahamic faiths, come to see Aristotle as more and more just one of us, really, right? Yes, we admit, of course, he was not a monotheist, but he's orthodox, as they put it in East Rome. He's the orthodox philosopher. What else do we need to say about the Book of the Pure Good, the Book of Causes, Liber de Causis, in terms of really getting our head around the role it plays in Proclan reception later on, the transformations?
Yeah, well, one thing to mention really goes with what you were just saying, this idea that Proclus is not objectionable to a monotheistic or Abrahamic perspective. That's proven very dramatically in the work of a 10th century philosopher named Al-Amiri, who wrote a work which, again, reworks and readapts the Arabic Proclus in a new form. This is a text that's been studied by someone who's now in Vienna named Elvira Wackelnig. And she actually edited and translated the text. It's really good. It's in German, the book. Mm-hmm. But if you can read German, it's a great book to look at. And so what's happening there is that Al-Amiri, who's a broadly Platonist philosopher who also knows as Aristotle and is somehow connected to the Al-Kindi circle through like chains of students, he writes a work where he basically recapitulates the Arabic Proclus stuff, but adding in more of his own ideas. And one of the things he now does is he explicitly brings in Quranic language to describe some of these principles. So for example, in the Quran, it says that God writes with a pen upon a tablet. And this is apparently supposed to like express the way that God knows everything that will happen. That would be one way of understanding it.
Right.
But Al-Amiri assigns the pen and the tablet to the principles of the cosmic hierarchy. So I guess the intellect is the pen and the soul is the tablet, or the other way around, right?
Right.
Or you get in the Ismaili tradition, who sort of proto-Shiite group of thinkers, you get them using more Plotinus than Proclus, actually, but you get them using Plotinus materials and combining that with their revelatory theology of the Imam, right? So that's one side of the kind of immediate reception. The other side is the fact that it was going under the name of Aristotle. And I've already said that Ibn Sina kind of doubted whether this Neoplatonic stuff is associated with Aristotle or is truly ascribed to Aristotle. But there's a very interesting text called The Harmony of the Two Philosophers, which is ascribed to Al-Farabi. Again, there's a scholarly dispute about whether it's really by Al-Farabi. But whoever wrote it, and we're now in the 10th century, so we're like a few generations after the Proclus materials were translated, he's trying to argue that the two philosophers, who are of course Plato and Aristotle, are in fact not in disagreement with each other about anything. That's the thesis of the work. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting, actually. He begins by saying, a lot of people are going around saying that Plato and Aristotle disagreed very strenuously on a number of topics. And that's an interesting fact, that he was aware that some people thought they weren't in harmony, right?
Yeah.
And then he goes on to say, this is wrong. They are in harmony. And I'll show you this by just going through a whole sequence of topics and citing passages from both Plato and Aristotle, in which I show you that, in fact, if you read them correctly, they agree.
Perfect.
And lo and behold, at one point he starts quoting so supposed Aristotle, and it's Proclus.
Yeah.
Right. So that's actually, this was part of what led Zimmermann to think that the Proclus material is part of this larger body of texts that also included Plotinus and went under the name of the theology of Aristotle. So I think he even says, Aristotle says in the theology that blah, blah, blah. And then the blah, blah, blah is taken from Arabic Proclus, not Arabic Plotinus.
Got it. So going back to Zimmermann's thesis, without derailing your point here, he thought not only did this dossier of cuttings from Plotinus and Proclus and maybe others exist, but that it circulated as such.
Yes.
It wasn't just, got it.
It must, or at least long enough for this person who is maybe Al-Farabi to know about it.
Yeah.
Right.
Got it.
Of course, he wouldn't need to have a complete version of the whole dossier, but he needs to at least know that the Proclus stuff is labeled as being part of the theology of Aristotle, right? And of course, once you think that Proclus is Aristotle, it becomes remarkably easy to reconcile Plato and Aristotle. So that's what he does. And so
Right.
he cites the Arabic Proclus under the name of Aristotle in order to show that Aristotle and Plato are in agreement. And then, you'll find modern day scholars saying, oh, he knows that this is BS and he's just saying this because it's convenient for him. You have other people saying, well, no, why would he make this up? That would be a terrible move, right? Because people could call him out on it. Or maybe it's
Right.
just like convenient and plausible enough to be part of his argument. And so he avails himself of the material. It's a little bit hard to tell. But in any case, he does it. So he actually cites it as evidence for Aristotle's own views.
It's not, we know, we have a case study, the last sort of 300 years of polytheist Platonist philosophy, almost unanimously argued that Aristotle and Plato were in harmony. Sometimes didn't, at a certain point, they stopped arguing. They just said, as we all know, Aristotle and Plato are completely harmonizable. And, you know, those who say they are not are just stupid, right? So they're often assuming this or arguing this, not from to make any particular point, you know, but just in, I think in general, just because it's good to have Aristotle on board as a member of the Platonist school. He's really good on physics. He's really good on, you know, some of the more kind of natural world type stuff that Plato doesn't cover.
Or maybe, I mean, another thing that's nice about it is that you get all of the great Greek philosophers to agree, right? So if you're in the business of promoting Greek philosophy, which is what certainly Al-Kindi was doing, then it would be quite inconvenient to say, oh, by the way, they're riven by profound disagreement about very fundamental metaphysical issues. Like Aristotle thought the theory of forms was a complete crock, right? That would be really inconvenient. So what Al-Kindi does is he tries to just sort of suppress anything that would suggest that there's a disagreement. In a couple of places, he explicitly says that they do agree. But you're right that in general, in the Islamic tradition, people tend to say that there's an agreement, although not always. So you do find people often latching onto Plato as a kind of figurehead that they can associate themselves with in order to attack the mainstream Aristotelian philosophical tradition. Like, for example, people will criticize later on, people will criticize Ibn Sina and they'll say, okay, he's a peripatetic or an Aristotelian. I'm a Platonist. So I disagree with him. So there's always that potential there. Or another example, a really interesting example would be the late Byzantine author Pletho.
My favorite.
Who... you might, but he's very much your kind of guy, Themistos Platon. He's probably like the patron saint of Schwepp, actually.
He's not the most he's Schweppy. not he's definitely in the iconostasis at Schwepp HQ for sure.
So he wrote one of the things he wrote. He's a like a flagrant Neoplatonist, right?
In fact,
hanging out in late Byzantium.
I think he is, you know, I don't really like to use the term Neoplatonist too much to describe Plotinus and his ilk because I feel like they're more just late Platonists. There's nothing that neo. With Plethon, he's a Neoplatonist.
Like, yeah, it fits, definitely.
Ficino and Plethon, this is where the term Neoplatonist really does have some usefulness.
Absolutely, yeah. And although I think that like Ficino, Plethon was probably also a sincere Christian, although... of what kind is
okay
hard to say, but
I can accept that for a Synesius of Cyrene or the pseudo Dionysius, but I don't buy it for Plethon. I reckon,
I mean, the thing is that he went, I mean, this is, we're now digressing, but he did go to the council where the Byzantines and Latin Christians met, and he apparently was extremely concerned that the Orthodox position went out with his theology. So that doesn't, I mean, either he like changed his mind a lot at some point, or we have to somehow reckon with him having reconciled in his mind this like a pretty outrageous version of Neoplatonism, like the kind we'd find in Ficino with Christianity. But of course, Ficino did the same thing.
Yes, but so, Ficino, I think it's safe to say, is trying to, he's working for some kind of renovatio of Christianity from within. He's not trying to overthrow it or destroy it. If anything, he's trying to kind of get rid of some of the cobwebs and get a brand spanking new shiny Christianity that's going to go into the future. There's problems, in other words, but Christianity is definitely the truth, way worth saving. I think Pleithon is like, burn it all. I honestly think that. I think he's like, destroy it. It's wrong. We need a... He's like some kind of crazy 1930s like nationalist. We need a new civilization, a new man. Destroy the old. Blah, blah, blah. Seriously. But that's my reading of him.
He's like a futurist.
Yeah, he's like a futurist or something. Or
well,
like
Dan in Rizzo. Any case, whatever his attitude towards Christianity was, he also wrote a very interesting work called On the Differences Between Plato and Aristotle. So this is sort of like the reverse of the harmony text from Arabic that we were just talking, although the two things aren't historically connected, where Pleithon is saying that Aristotle and Plato do disagree about all kinds of things, and Aristotle is always wrong.
And Plato is right. And that, again, Aristotle is orthodox. So what does that make Pleithon arguing that Plato is right? Well, it kind of makes him like...
Yeah, that's interesting. Orthodox. So at the beginning, he associates Aristotle with the Latin scholastics and Averroes. Even in fact, he names Averroes, which is really interesting to see Averroes' name turning up in Greek in the late Byzantine.
In Constantinople, yeah, yeah.
In Constantinople, yeah. Or in Greece, where Pleithon was. I don't know where he wrote this. So in any case, actually, I think that my personal view of this is that his anti-Aristotle polemic is actually an anti-Latin Christian polemic.
Exactly.
So he's polemicizing against the Latin scholastics by attacking their favorite guy, Aristotle. And he's saying, this guy is not orthodox in either the technical or general sense. He's someone whose views are incompatible with Christianity. Whereas Plato has a providential creator God, like we do. That's, I think, the message of that text, actually.
So I wonder, I agree with you. That's definitely part of it. And I wonder if you take that reading and apply it to his interactions at the Council of Florence Ferrara, where they're trying to hash out some kind of theological compromise so as to get some ships to fight the Turks, essentially, so as to, you know, get some military aid. Couldn't it be the case that he's, let's take the Pleithon, the all Christianity is stupid thinker as a postulate. Couldn't it be the case that he's arguing for orthodoxy just because he's like a bit of a xenophobic Latin? He's like, these barbarians, they have this like stupid theology. Of course, if we're going to argue for theology, it has to be the orthodox theology, which is the theology of my Hellenic imperial home, not these smelly, you know, barbarians, basically. So it's like kind of like a racist thing rather than a theological thing. I can imagine that. We don't have nearly enough evidence about what went on and what the arguments were and who the people involved were, but I could see that happening. Him just being like doggedly arguing for a strongly pro-Orthodox stance, not because he has a theological commitment to it, but because it's the home team and these guys, these Latins.
Yeah, you know, that's certainly possible. Yeah. Yeah, I think that he probably thought that he might even have thought that there is some kind of philosophical truth, which is the core truth, and it's basically Proclus. And then, getting back to Proclus, and then there are various ways of expressing this, and one expression of it would be orthodox theology.
I can see that.
Another expression of it would be pagan religion, but it's kind of all, you know, a merely human reflection of some more profound truth, which would be fully philosophical. That's more where I lean. But so when I was saying that I think he's a Christian, what I meant was that I think he thinks that Christianity is a religion that reflects the truth.
Christianity is compatible with the truth, right? Rather than it is.
Yeah, maybe. Or is even an expression of the truth. But if you really want to know what the truth is, then you should study Proclus. But of course, that would be for the elite initiated philosophers.
I see that for sure. I can definitely see that. That was a serious digression, and I don't regret anything.
Sorry.
Yeah.
I would do it again.
I double down. Peter Adamson, thank you for this incredible expose on the Proclean reception in Arabic and this even more incredible excursus into the wilds of late Roman esotericism. But I don't want to let you go until we've kind of tied a bow onto this story of Proclan reception. When last we met Proclus Arabus, he was being sort of used in 10th century philosophic debates about, well, philosophic matters. What happens after that? We haven't even got to Latin yet, so I know this book is going to end up in Latin.
Yeah. Yeah, so the later reception of the Arabic Neoplatonist stuff is mostly focused on Plotinus and not Proclus. There is a commentary on the Liber de Causis later on in Arabic, but by far the most dominant text is the Theology of Aristotle, meaning here the Arabic Plotinus. So I think the most interesting thing we haven't talked about much is the commentary on the Liber de Causis by Aquinas. So that would take us up to the 13th century in Latin, right? And as I said, he says in that commentary, oh, guys, this is actually Proclus. So not Aristotle, but interestingly, still thinks that it's worth writing a commentary on it. And the reason he's doing this is that he wants to compare the views of the people he calls the Platonists, which is kind of his word for what we would call Neoplatonists. So he wants to compare them to the works of someone you've mentioned, who is the Pseudo-Dionysius.
Dun dun.
Dun dun. Right. He's always there in the background, waiting to draw you into the cloud of unknowing. And so his role here is to provide Aquinas with a kind of contrast case. So he says, well, the Platonists are pagans and they think X, Y, and Z. And you see a very similar view, but in a way that's appropriate to Christianity in Dionysius.
Got it.
Now, of course, this is deeply ironic because we know that this guy who was calling himself Dionysius was in fact influenced by Proclus, right?
Yeah, if not Damascius.
But for sure, at least Proclus. And Aquinas thinks that Dionysius is this apostolic figure who's like a founding figure in the history of Christian intellectual culture, right? And in fact, lived before Proclus, because if he's the Dionysius who's mentioned incidentally in the Bible, then of course he's several hundred years before Proclus. So in a way, if anyone's influencing anyone, it would be Proclus stealing ideas from Dionysius and not the other way around.
Yep.
Now, I think Aquinas has really been very insightful here, despite this historical error, to notice that there's a lot of resonances between Dionysius and Proclus, because of course there are. He doesn't know why. But he says, well, Platonists will say this, or Proclus will say this, Dionysius will say something else, and we agree with Dionysius. So his commentary is almost like a filtering out of pagan Neoplatonism from Christian Platonism, which is what he wants to embrace. He also wrote a commentary on the divine names of Dionysius. So there's an author who really meant a lot to him. And he's juxtaposing Dionysius with this extremely mediated, which is quite appropriate, right? Mediation. So this extremely mediated access that he has to Proclus, right? So it's come through this garbled transmission through Arabic, then translated into Latin. And then all of a sudden they've got the elements of theology in Greek, right? And so they can compare all these things, and he starts drawing some conclusions and figuring out, as it were, which kind of Platonism he thinks is really acceptable and usable for Christians.
Mm. Layers upon layers upon layers of influence from Platonism writ broadly into Christianity, right? You have the works of the Pseudo-Dionysius. That has its own reception history and leads to its own Platonism. Well, first of all, you have Christianity itself, which is already within a Hellenic matrix and has some kind of Platonistic presuppositions in the source texts. It's hard to imagine the Gospel of John, for example, being written if there had never been a Plato, right? Then you have various forms of esoteric Platonist Christianity in antiquity, like the Origenists and so on, the Gnostics. Then you have the Pseudo-Dionysius, which is suddenly the most wacky out there apophatic Platonism imaginable, pretty much, is orthodox, officially stamped, sealed, and delivered. And that is going to then, you know, get translated into Latin multiple times, have numerous adventures along the way. So by the time you get to Aquinas, when you're importing the Greek elements of theology into that incredibly complex, layered reception history of Platonic ideas, it's a wonder to behold, actually, this intellectual.
Yeah, history. And in a way, he's just facing the same situation we are, right? So we're trying to tease apart all these layers, figure out how they interrelate, and that's what he was doing as well.
Mm. Yeah, with a slightly less good textual tools to go with, a lot less good. So that's that. Now, before we say farewell to our Book of the Pure Good, does it go on, do you know, to have a reception history in more modern, or say early modern or modern Islamic thought? Is it something, for example, that modern Kalam scholars still think with?
I don't think so. So I think the Proclus doesn't really have a long reverberation in the Islamic world the way Plotinus does. The Arabic Plotinus is taken up by philosophers in the Safavid period, like Mulla Sadr. So that's early modern Iran. So we're talking like 16th, 17th century. The Arabic Plotinus is still influential. So the Al-Kindi Neoplatonic project is still being influential then, but not so much the Proclus, more the Plotinus. In the Latin sphere, you have a very influential work by Proclus, which is his commentary on Euclid's Elements. Yeah. And that becomes really important for, you know, mathematics, philosophy of mathematics, and so on. So that has a lot of impact on philosophers in the Renaissance, for example. That's not something I know a lot about, but it's not like Proclus vanishes. Mm. He kind of does vanish in the Islamic world to a larger extent.
The Euclid commentary was read by such luminaries as Kepler. And
yeah, exactly.
Yeah, wonderful book.
Another Platonist.
Indeed, indeed. And a man who showed that Platonists can and do make really, really incredible scientific advances and don't necessarily have to think all movements in the sky are in perfect circles and stuff like that, but can be incredibly imaginative and make intuitive leaps, which might go against the sort of stereotype of a Platonist that someone like Newton would have put about, that they're just stuck in thinking about substances that never change and, you know, they're never going to really innovate anything in the natural sciences. It's like, boom, here comes Kepler.
Yeah. And that criticism actually goes all the way back to Aristotle, right? So the problem with Platonic forms is they can't explain why anything happens.
Mm. I guess the problem with the criticism is then you can't explain how you can have ideas about the forms not explaining anything that's ever happened without the forms to explain the epistemology in the first place. But that's going to take us down another alley. Peter Adamson, you're the man. Thank you so much for this enlightening and really, really fascinating discussion of the fate of Proclus in Arabic. Until we have the good fortune to speak again, stay esoteric.
Thank you. Thanks for having me back.